This is Audible.
Recorded Books and RB Digital present Iron Gold by Pierce Brown. Narrated by John Curlis, Julian Elfer, Aideen Maloney, and Tim Gerard Reynolds. The Fall of Mercury. The Fury. Silent, she waits for the sky to fall. Standing upon an island of volcanic rock amidst a black sea. The long moonless night yawns before her. The only sounds, a flapping banner of war, held in her lover's hand, and the warm waves that kiss her steel boots. Her heart is heavy, her spirit wild. Peerless knights tower behind her, salt spray beads on her family crests. Emerald centaurs, screaming eagles, gold sphinxes, and the crowned skull of her father's grim house. Her golden eyes look to the heavens, waiting. The water heaves in, out, the heartbeat of her silence. The City. Tyche, the jewel of Mercury, hunches in fear between the mountains and the sun. Her famed glass and limestone spires are dark. The ancestor bridge is empty. Here, Lorn au Arcus wept as a young man when he saw the messenger planet at sunset for the first time. Now, trash rolls through her streets, pushed by salty summer wind. Gone are the calls of the fishmongers at the wharf. Gone are the patter of pedestrian feet on the cobbles and the rubble of air cars and the laughter of the low-colour children who jump from the bridges into the waves on scorching summer days when the Trasmian sea winds are still. The city is quiet. Its wealthy already gone to desert mountain retreats or government bunkers, its soldiers on its rooftops watching the sky. Its poor, having left for the desert, or upon cramped boats destined for the Izmir Islands. But the city is not empty. Huddled masses fill the public transit systems that wend beneath the waves, and in the upstairs window of a tenement complex, on the ugly fringes of the city, far from the water where the working poor are kept, a little girl with orange eyes fogs the window with her breath. The night sky sparks, flashing and flaring with spurts of light like the fireworks her brother sometimes buys at the corner shop. She's been told there is a battle between big fleets high up there. She's never seen a starship. Her mother lies sick in the bedroom, unable to travel. Her father, who builds parts for engines, sits at the little plastic dinner table with his sons, knowing he cannot protect them. The hollow can washes them in pale light. Government news programs tell them to seek shelter. In her pocket, the girl carries a folded piece of paper that she found in the gutter. On it is a little curved sword. She's seen it before on the cube. Her teachers at the government school say it brings chaos, war. It has set the spheres on fire. But now she secretly draws the blade in the fog her breath has made on the window, and she feels brave. Then the bombs begin to fall. The bombs. They come from high-orbit Thor-class bombers, piloted by farm boys from Earth and miners from Mars of the 12th Sunshine Squadron. Curses and prayers and tribal dragons and curved scythes have been sprayed upon them in aerosol paint. They dip through the clouds and fall over the sea, outracing their own sound. Their guidance chips are made by Free Colors on Phobos. Their steel is mined and smelted by entrepreneurs in the belt. Their iron propulsion engines are stamped with the winged heel of a company that makes consumer electronics and toiletries and weapons. Down and down they go, to race shadowless over the desert, then the sea, carrying the weight of the newest empire under the sun. The first bomb destroys the Hall of Justice on Tyche's Vespasian Island. Then it burrows 100 meters into the earth before detonating against the bunker buried there, killing all inside. The second lands in the sea, 15 kilometers from a fleet of refugees, where it sinks a society warship hiding under the chop. The third races over a spine of mountains north of Tyche, when it is struck with a railgun round fired from a defense installation by a grey teenager with acne scars and the charm of a sweetheart around his neck. It careens off its course and sputters across the sky before falling to the earth. It detonates on the fringes of the city, far from the water, where it turns 4 blocks of tenement housing to dust. The Reaper. Silent, he lies encased in man-killing metal in the belly of a starship called the Morning Star. The fear swallows him now, as it has done time and time before. The only sound is the whir of his armor's air filtration unit and the radio chatter of distant men and women. Around him lie his friends, they too cocooned in metal, waiting. Eyes red and gold and grey and obsidian. Wolf heads mark their pauldrons, tattoos their necks and arms. Wild empire breakers from Mars and Luna and Earth. Beyond them fly ships with names like Spirit of Lycos, Hope of Tinos, and Echo of Ragnar. They are painted white and led by a woman with onyx dark skin. The Lion Sovereign said the white was for spring, for a new beginning. But the ships are stained, smeared with char and patched wounds and mismatched panels. They broke the Sword Armada and the Martyr Fabii. They conquered the heart of the Gold Empire. They battled the Ash Lord to the core and have kept the dragons of the Rim at bay. How could they ever stay clean? Alone in his armor, waiting to fall from the sky, he remembers the girl who began it all. He remembers how her red hair fell over her eyes, how her mouth danced with laughter, how she breathed as she lay atop him, so warm and fragile in a world far too cold. She has been dead longer than she was ever alive. And now that her dream has spread, he wonders if she would recognize it. And he wonders, too, if he were to die today, would he recognize the echo of his own life? What sort of man would his son become in this world he has made? He thinks of his son's face, and how soon he will become a man. And he thinks of his golden wife, as she stood on the landing pad, looking up at him, wondering if he'd ever return home again. More than anything, he wants this to end. Then the machine takes hold. He feels the tug on his body, the pounding of his heart, the mad cackling of the goblin and the howls of his friends as they try to forget their children, their loves, and be brave. Nausea in his gut rises as the magnetic rails charge behind him. With a shudder of metal, they fire him forward through the launch tube, out into silent space at 6 times the speed of sound. Men call him Father, Liberator, Warlord, Slave King, Reaper. But he feels a boy as he falls toward the war-torn planet. His armor red, his army vast, his heart heavy. It is the 10th year of war, and the 33rd of his life. Part 1. Wind. From Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. There is a poor, blind Samson in this land, shorn of his strength and bound in bonds of steel, who may, in some grim revel, raise his hand and shake the pillars of his commonweal, till the vast temple of our liberties, a shapeless mass of wreck and rubbish, lies. Chapter 1. Darrow, Hero of the Republic. Weary, I walk upon flowers at the head of an army. Petals carpet the last of the stone road before me. Thrown by children from windows, they twirl lazily down from the steel towers that grow to either side of the lunar boulevard. In the sky, the sun dies its slow, week-long death, staining the tattered clouds and gathered crowd in bloody hues. Waves of humanity lap against security barricades, pressing inward on our parade as Hyperion city watchmen in grey uniforms and cyan berets guard the route, shoving drunken revellers back into the crowd. Behind them, anti-terrorism units prowl up and down the pavement, their fly-eyed goggles scanning irises, hands resting on energy weapons. My own eyes rove the crowd. After 10 years of war, I no longer believe in moments of peace. It's a sea of colours that line the 12-kilometer Via Triumphia, built by my people, the red slaves of the golds, hundreds of years ago. The Triumphia is the avenue by which the conquerors who tamed Earth held their own processions, as they claimed continent after continent. Iron-spined murderers with eyes of gold and haughty menace once consecrated these same stones. Now, nearly a millennium later, we sully the Triumphia's sacred white marble by honouring liberators with eyes of jet and ash and rust and soil. Once, this would have filled me with pride. Jubilant crowds celebrating the free legions, returning from vanquishing yet another threat to our fledgling republic. But today, I see hollow signs of my head with a bloody crown atop it, hear the jeers from the vox populi, as they wave banners emblazoned with their upside-down pyramid, and feel nothing but the weight of an endless war and a desperate longing to be once again in the embrace of my family. It has been a year since I have seen my wife and son. After the long voyage back from Mercury, all I want is to be with them, to fall into a bed, and to sleep for a dreamless month. The last of my journey home lies before me. As the Triumphia widens and abuts the stairs that lead up to the new forum, I face one final summit. Faces drunk on jubilation and new commercial spirits gape up at me as I reach the stairs. Hands sticky with sweets wave in the air, and tongues loose from those same commercial spirits and delights cry out, shouting my name or cursing it. Not the name my mother gave me, but the name my deeds have built. The name the fallen peerless scarred now whisper as a curse. Reaper, 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 they cry, not in unison, but in frenzy. The clamour suffocates, squeezing with a billion-fingered hand, all the hopes, all the dreams, all the pain constricting around me. But so close to the end, I can put one foot after the other. I begin to climb the stairs. Clunk. My metal boots grind on stone with the weight of loss. Eel, Ragnar, Fichtner, and all the others who fought and fallen at my side, while somehow I have remained alive. I am tall and broad, thicker at my age of 33 than I was in my youth, stronger and more brutal in my build and movement. Born red, made gold. I have kept what Mickey the Carver gave me. These gold eyes and hair feel more my own than those of the boy who lived in the mines of Lycos. That boy grew, loved, and dug the earth. But he lost so much, it often feels like it happened to another soul. Clunk. Another step. Sometimes I fear that this war is killing that boy inside. I ache to remember him, his raw, pure heart. To forget this city moon, this solar war, and return to the bosom of the planet that gave birth to me before the boy inside is dead forever. Before my son loses the chance to ever know him. But the worlds, it seems, have plans of their own. Clunk. I feel the weight of the chaos I've unleashed. Famines and genocide on Mars, obsidian piracy in the belt, terrorism, radiation sickness and disease spreading through the lower reaches of Luna, and the 200 million lives lost in my war. I force a smile. Today is our fourth Liberation Day. After 2 years of siege, Mercury has joined the free worlds of Luna, Earth, and Mars. Bars stand open. War-weary citizens rove the streets, looking for a reason to celebrate. Fireworks crackle and blaze across the sky, shot from the roofs of skyscraper and tenement complex alike. With our victory, on the first planet from the sun, the Ash Lord has been pushed back to his last bastion, the fortress planet Venus, where his battered fleet guards precious docks and the remaining loyalists. I have come home to convince the Senate to requisition ships and men of the war-impoverished Republic for one final campaign, one last push on Venus to put this bloody damn war to rest, so I can set down the sword and go home to my family for good. Clunk. I take a moment to glance behind me. Waiting at the foot of the stairs is my 7th Legion, or the remnants of it. 28,000 men and women, where once there were 50. They stand in casual order around a 14-pointed ivory star with a Pegasus galloping at its center, held aloft by the famous Thraxa Autelemanos, the Hammer. After losing her left arm to Atlantia Augrimus's razor, she had it replaced by a metal prototype appendage from Sun Industries. Wild gold hair flutters behind her head, garlanded with white feathers given to her by obsidian admirers. In her mid-30s, a stout woman with thighs thick as water drums and a freckled, bluff face. She grins past the shoulders of the obsidians and golds around her. Blue and red and orange pilots wave to the crowd. Red, grey and brown infantry smile and laugh as pretty young pinks and reds duck under barriers and rush to drape necklaces of flowers around their necks, push bottles of liquor into their hands and kisses onto their mouths. They are the only full legion in today's parade. The rest remain on Mercury, with Orion and Harnassus, battling with the Ash Lord's legions stranded there when his fleet retreated. Clunk. Remember, you are but mortal. Severo's bored voice drawls in my ear as white-haired Wulfgar and the Republic Wardens descend to greet us midway up the forum stairs. Severo sniffs my neck and makes a noise of distaste. By Jove, you wretch. Did you dip yourself in piss before the occasion? It's cologne, I say. Mustang bought it for me last solstice. He's quiet for a moment. Is it made out of piss? I scowl back at him, wrinkling my nose at the heaviness of liquor on his breath, and eye the ragged wolf cloak he wears over his ceremonial armour. He claims he hasn't washed it since the Institute. You're really lecturing me about stenches. Just shut up and behave like an imperator, I say with a grin. Snorting, Severo drops back to where the legendary obsidian, Cephi Volaris, stands in her customary silence. He feigns an air of domesticity, but next to the giant woman he looks a little like some sort of gutter dog an alcoholic father might ill-advisedly bring home to play with the children, washed and rid of fleas, but still possessing that weird mania behind the eyes. Pinched, thin-lipped, with a nose crooked as an old knife-fighter's fingers, he eyes the crowd with resigned distaste. Behind him lope the pack of mangy howlers he brought with us to Mercury. My bodyguards, now drunk as gallants at a Lycos laurel tide, stalwart Holiday walks at their centre, the snub-nosed woman doing her best to keep them in line. There used to be more of them. So many more. I smile as Wolfgar descends the stairs to meet me. A favourite son of the rising, the obsidian is a tree root of a man, gnarled and narrow, armoured all in pale blue. He's in his early 40s, his face angular as a raptor's, his beard braided like that of his hero, Ragnar. One of the obsidians to fight alongside Ragnar at the walls of Aegir, Wolfgar was with the sons of Ares that freed me from the jackal in Attica. Now, Archwarden of the Republic, he smiles down at me from the step above, his black eyes crinkling at the corners. Hail Libertas, I say with a smile.
Hail Libertas, he echoes.
Wolfgar, fancy meeting you here. You missed the rain, I say.
You did not wait for me to return, did you?
Wolfgar clucks his tongue.
My children will ask where I was when the rain fell upon Mercury, and you know what I will have to tell them?
He leans forward in a conspiratorial smile. I was making night soil, wiping my ass when I heard Barca had taken Mount Caloris. He rumbles out a laugh.
I told you not to leave, Severo says. You'd miss out on all the fun, I said. You should have seen the Ashes rout. Trails of piss all the way to Venus. You'd have loved it.
Severo grins at the obsidian. It was Severo who put a razor in his hand in the river mud of Aegir. Wolfgar has his own razor now, its hilt made from the fang of an ice dragon from Earth's south pole.
My blade would have sung that day, were I not summoned by the Senate, he says.
Severo sneers.
That's right. You ran home like a good little dog.
A dog? I am a servant of the people, my friend, as are we all.
His eyes find me with mild accusation, and I understand the true meaning to his words. Wolfgar is a believer, like all wardens, not in me, but in the Republic, in the principles for which it stands, and the orders that the Senate gives. 2 days before the iron rain over Mercury, the Senate, led by my old friend Dancer, voted against my proposal. They told me to maintain the siege, to not waste men, resources, on an assault. I disobeyed and let the rain fall. Now a million of my men lie on the sands of Mercury, and we have our liberation day. Were Wolfgar with me on Mercury, he would not have joined our reign against the Senate's permission. In fact, he might have tried to stop me. He's one of the few men alive who might manage. For a spell, at least. He spares a nod for Cephi.
Nyargahe, Svester.
A rough translation is, respect to you, sister, in Nagal.
Nyargahir, Bruder,
she replies. No love lost between them. They have different priorities.
Your weapons.
Wulfgar gestures to my razor. Seffi and I hand his wardens our weapons. Muttering under his breath, Severo hands over his as well.
Did you forget your toothpick?
Wulfgar asks, looking at Severo's left boot.
Treasonous yeti, Severo mutters, and pulls a wicked blade long as a baby's body from his boot.
The warden who takes it looks terrified.
Odin's fortune with the togas, Darrow,
Wulfgar says to me as he motions for us to continue upward.
You will need it.
Arrayed at the top of the steps of the new forum are the 140 senators of the Republic. 10 per colour, all draped in white togas that flutter in the breeze. They peer down at me like a row of haughty pigeons on a wire. Red and gold, mortal enemies in the Senate, bookend the row to either side. Dancer is missing, but I have eyes only for the lonely bird of prey that stands at the centre of all the silly, vain, power-hungry little pigeons. Her golden hair is bound tight behind her head. Her tunic is pure white, without the ribbons of their colour the others wear. And in her hand she carries the dawn sceptre, now a multi-hued gold baton, half a metre long, with the pyramid of the society recast into the 14-pointed star of the Republic at its tip. Her face is elegant and distant. A small nose, piercing eyes behind thick eyelashes, and a mischievous cat's smile growing on her face. The sovereign of our republic. Here at the summit of the stairs, her eyes shed the weight from my shoulders, the fear from my heart that I would never see her again. Through war and space and this damnable parade, I have travelled to find her again. My life, my love, my home. I bend to my knee and look up into the eyes of the mother of my child.
Lo, wife, I say with a smile.
Lo, husband, welcome home. Chapter 2. Darrow, father. Selene Manor, the Sovereign's traditional lunar country retreat, is nestled 500 kilometres north of Hyperion, at the base of the Atlas Mountains, on a small lake. The northern hemisphere of the moon, comprised of mountains and seas, is less populous than the belt of cities that girdle the equator. Though Mustang governs from the Palace of Light in the Citadel, Selene is the true home of my family, at least until we return to Mars. Built to resemble one of the papal villas on Earth's Lake Como, the stone house sits along the edge of a rocky cove and spills down to the lake by means of switch-backed stairs cut into the rock. Here the thin conifers whisper to heights 4 times those possible on Earth. They sway nearly 200 metres in the air around the raised concrete landing pad where the steward of House Augustus, Cedric Ku Platu, waits with my wife's lion guards as our shuttle lands. The small copper greets Severo and me with great alacrity, bowing deeply and flourishing his hand. Thraxa runs past him without even a greeting, eager to find her mother.
Arch Imperator,
he gushes, plump cheeks flushing with delight. He's a short but ample man, built a bit like a plum with knobby arms and legs added as an afterthought. A whisper of a moustache, nearly as thin as the graying copper hair on his head, wavers in the wind.
What gladness to see you again!
Cedric, I say, greeting the short man warmly,
I hear you've just had a birthday.
Yes, my lord, my 71st, though I do maintain one should stop counting after 60.
Prime work, Severo says. You look positively prepubescent.
Thank you, my lord.
Few know the secrets of the Citadel as well as Cedric. He was one of the gems of the Sovereign's court. Mustang, having thought highly of him during her time with Octavia, saw no need to dismiss a man so knowledgeable and dedicated to his duty.
Where's the welcoming party?
Severo asks, looking for his wife, Victra. Mustang and Daxo remained behind in Hyperion to deal with their unruly senate, but promised to rejoin by dinner time.
Oh, the children are recently returned from a 3-day adventure, Cedric says. The Lady Telemannus took them to the ruins of the USS Davy Crockett in the Atlas Mountains, Merriwater's own. I hear they had quite a time around that old wreck. Quite a time, yes. Learned many lessons and expanded their individual initiative. As your curriculum requested, Domin...
Cedric's eyes nearly pop out of his head before he corrects himself.
As your curriculum requested, sir.
Is my wife here yet?
Severo asks gruffly.
Not yet, sir. Her valet said she would be late to dinner.
I believe there were labor strikes in her warehouses in Endymion and Echo City.
It's all over the Hollow News.
She didn't even show to the Triumph, Severo mutters. I looked fabulous.
She has missed you at your most prime, sir.
Right. See, Darrow. Cedric agrees.
What he hasn't noticed is Cedric shuffling away from the odious stench of his wolf cloak.
Cedric, where is my son?
I ask the man. He smiles.
I think you can guess, sir.
The sounds of neoplast swords knocking together and boots on stone greet Severo and me as we enter the dueling grotto. There, vines crawl over granite fountains and along the damp stone floor. Evergreen needles drift in cumulus shapes from the top of the trees. And in the center of the grotto, under the watchful eyes of the gargoyles adorning the fountains, a young boy and girl circle each other at the center of a chalk circle. The 7 other children of their pack watch on, along with 2 gold women. Severo pulls me to the side, so we remain unseen, and sit out of sight on the edge of a granite fountain to watch. The boy at the center of the circle is 10, lean and proud. He laughs like his mother and broods like his father. His hair is the color of straw, his face round and flushed with youth. Rose-gold eyes burn from under long lashes. He's larger than I remember, older, and it feels so impossible that he could have come from me, that he could have thoughts of his own, that he'll love, smile, die like the rest of us. His brow is furrowed now, in concentration. Sweat pours down his face, matting his hair as his opponent strikes his knee a glancing blow. The girl is 9 and narrow-faced, like a sleek hunting dog. Electra, the eldest of Severo's 3 daughters, is taller than my son and twice as thin. But while Pax radiates an inner joy that makes adults' eyes twinkle, there's a deep grimness to the girl. Her eyes are dusky gold and hidden behind heavy lids. Sometimes, when they look at me, I feel them judging with an aloofness that reminds me of her mother. Severo leans forward eagerly.
I'll wager Azure's razor against Apollonius's helm that my wee monster beats the piss out of your boy. I'm not going to bet on our children, I whisper in indignation. I'll throw Azure's institute ring in as well.
Have some decency, Severo. There are children. And Octavia's cape? I want the Forth ivory tree.
Several gasps. I love the ivory tree. Where else will I hang my trophies?
I shrug. No ivory tree, no bet.
Bloody damn savage, he says,
sticking out a hand to shake. You have a deal. Severo's become quite the collector, acquiring a hoard of trophies from gold imperators, knights, and would-be kings. He hangs their rings and weapons and crests from the boughs of the ivory tree he uprooted from the House Falth compound on Earth and moved to his home on Luna. We watch as Electra redoubles her onslaught against Pax. My son continues to back away, to sidestep, allowing her to overextend. Once she does, he twirls his plastic razor toward her ribcage. It connects lightly.
Point! He shouts. I'm counting, Pax, not you,
Niobe O'Telemana says.
Kavix's wife is a serene woman, with a bird's nest of untamable greying hair and skin the colour of cherrywood.
The tribal tattoos of her Pacific Islander ancestors cover her arms.
3-2 for Pax. Mind your balance and stop overextending, Electra, says Thraxa. You lose your footing if you're on an unstable surface, like a ship deck or ice.
She sits on the edge of a fountain, miraculously already having found a bottle of beer. Brow furrowed in anger, Electra rushes Pax again. They move fast for children, but since they're still shy of puberty, their movements are not yet graceful. Electra faints high, then twists her wrist to slash savagely down, hitting Pax's shoulder.
Point for Electra, Niobe says.
Severo has to stop himself from clapping. Pax tries to recover, but Electra is on him. 3 more quick blows knock his razor from his hand. He falls down, and Electra lifts her razor to smash him hard on the head. Thraxa slips forward and catches the blade mid-swing with her metal hand.
Temper, temper, little lady.
She pours a little beer on her head. Electra glares up at her.
Severo can't contain himself any longer. My little harpy!
He lunges up off the bench, and I follow, through to the grotto.
Daddy's home!
A smile slashes across Electra's dour face as she turns to see her father. She runs to him and lets him scoop her up off the ground. Looks rather like he's hugging a limp fish. Some of the children flinch back when they see Severo, and when they see me emerge from behind the vines, they stiffen and bow with perfect manners. Not one born since the fall of House Loon has the sigils implanted on their hands. We raise them in packs of 9 now, setting children of disparate colours together early in their schooling, with hopes of creating the bonds that I found at the Institute, but without the murder and starvation. Pax's best friend, Baldur, a quiet, gap-toothed obsidian boy, who is already nearly as tall as Severo, helps Pax up. He tries to dust Pax off before Pax shoos him away and looks over at us. I expected him to rush to me like Electra, but he doesn't. And in that moment, a very sharp spasm of pain goes through the deeper part of me. When I left him, he was a boy, brimming with reckless life. But the hesitation, the coldness in him now, is from the world of men. Minding his pack, he walks forward very calmly and bows at the waist, no deeper than manners require. Hello, father.
My boy, I say with a smile. You've grown like a weed.
That's what happens when you age, he says, an edge to his words. I always thought when I became a man I'd feel more confident, but towering over this boy, I feel so very small. I lost my own father to a cause.
Have I doomed Pax to the same fate?
He's not generally such a snot,
Niobe says later, as we stand to the side after the children are dismissed from the day's practice. Pax leaves quickly, and in a mood. Baldur rushes to keep up.
Take the angst as a compliment, Darrow,
Thraxa mumbles.
He just misses his father. I felt the same way any time the old man was away on one of Augustus's errands.
She pulls a slim burner from her pocket and lights it in the coals of one of the copper braziers that line the crumbling walls of the grotto. Niobe plucks it from her fingers and puts it out on her daughter's metal arm. Was Daxo ever like that? I ask.
Daxo?
Niobe laughs.
Daxo was born stoic as a stone.
Plotting in the womb from conception, Thraxa mutters, and sips her beer.
We used to make owl hoots at him, always watching the rest of us out the window.
Big Brother never wanted to play our games, only his own.
And you were such a paragon, Niobe asks. You used to eat cow pies.
Thraxa shrugs. Better than your cooking. She steps out of range of her mother's reach and lights a replacement burner.
Thank Jove we had browns.
Niobe rolls her eyes and touches my arm.
The miscreant is right, Darrow. Pax just missed you. You've time to make up.
I smile at her, but watch Severo walking away toward the water with Electra.
You know your daddy's favorite, don't you?
He sang to her. I fight back my jealousy. He always seems able to pick right back up where he left off with his family. I wish I had that same gift. I seek my mother out in the garden that runs along the side of one of the stone storage sheds. She's hunched in the black dirt with two other red servant women and a red man, her bare feet sticking out behind her as she plants bulbs in the ground in tidy rows. I pause a moment at the edge of the garden to watch her, just as I used to watch from the stairwell in our little home in Lycos as she made her night tea. I was afraid of her after Father died. She was always quick with a swat or a barbed word. I thought I deserved the treatment. How much easier the love between us would have been if I'd known as a child that her anger and my fear came from a pain neither one of us deserved. The love in me wells up for her as I remember what she's endured, and for a brief flicker I ache to see my father again, for him to see my mother free.
Are you just going to watch like a wastrel, or are you going to help us plant?
She asks without looking up. I'm not sure I'd be a good farmer, I say. She stands with the help of one of her companions, dusts the dirt from her pants, and takes her time setting her tools away before coming to say hello. She's only 18 years older than I am, but she wears the years hard. Still, she is stronger by leagues than when she lived below. Her joints are worn from years in the mines, but her cheeks are ruddy with life now. Our physicians have helped relieve most of the symptoms of the stroke and heart condition that ravaged her. I know she feels guilty for this life, this luxury, when my father and so many others wait for us in the vale. Her work in the garden and on the grounds is a penance for surviving. My mother gives me a hard hug.
My son.
She breathes me in before pulling back to look all the way up to my face.
You put the death in me when I heard of that damn iron rain. You put the death in all of us.
I'm sorry. They shouldn't have told you before that I was unaccounted for. She nods and says nothing, and I realize how deep her worry went. How they must have huddled in the living room here or in the citadel and listened to the hollow news just like everyone else. The red man shuffles to join us, his bad leg dragging behind. "Lo, Dancer," I say past my mother. My old mentor wears labourer's garments instead of his senatorial robes. His hair is grey, his face fatherly and creased from hard years. But there's still mischief in his rebel eyes.
"Given up the Senate for gardening, have you?"
"I'm a man of the people," he says with a shrug. "Good to have dirt under the nails again. The gardeners in that museum the Senate gave me won't let me touch a damn weed."
"Lo, Severo."
"Politician,"
Severo says, joining me from behind. Heedless of the mood, he pretends like he's going to scoop my mother up into the air, but she scowls at him, and he turns the scoop into a gentle hug.
"Better," she says. "You nearly broke my hip the last time."
"Oh, don't be such a pixie," he mutters.
"Say that again."
He steps back.
"Nothing, Mom."
"What word from Liana?" I ask.
"They're well. Was hoping to visit them soon. Maybe take Pax along to Icaria in the winter. This place gets too cold for these old bones."
"All the way to Mars?" I ask.
"It's his home," she says sharply. "You want him to forget where he came from? Red's as deep in his blood as gold. Not that he's ever reminded it, except by me."
Dancer looks away, as if to give us privacy.
"He'll go to Mars," I say. "We all will, when it's safe."
We might control Mars, but that's a far cry from it being a world of harmony. The Serenian continent is still infested by a gold army of iron-skinned veterans, just like the battleground of South Pacifica on Earth. The Ashlord hasn't risked putting a major fleet in orbit in years, but ground wars are decidedly more stubborn than their astral counterparts.
"And when will it be safe, according to you?"
my mother asks.
"Soon."
Neither Dancer nor my mother is impressed by that answer.
"And how long are you staying here?" she asks.
"A month at least.
Rona and Kieran will be coming, like you asked."
"About bloody time. Thought Mercury had stolen them."
"Victor and the girls will come up for a spell too, though I do have business in Hyperion at the end of the week."
"With the Senate? Asking for more men?"
Her tone's as sour as her eyes. I sigh and look at Dancer.
"Infecting my mother with your politics now?"
He laughs.
"Diana most certainly has a mind of her own."
"With both of you in my ears, I'll go deaf," she says.
"Plug your ears," Severo replies. "It's what I do when they jabber about politics."
Dancer snorts.
"If only our wife did the same."
"Careful, boyo. She's got ears everywhere. She could be listening now."
"Why weren't you at the Triumph?"
I ask Dancer.
He grimaces. "Please. We both know I've got no stomach for pomp. Especially on this damn moon. Give me dirt and air and friends."
He looks fondly at the trees around. A shadow passes over his face at the thought of returning to Hyperion.
"Well, I must be heading back to the mechanized Babylon. Diana, thank you for letting me garden with you. It's just what I needed."
"You're not staying for supper?"
my mother asks.
"Unfortunately, there are other gardens that need tending. Speaking of which,
Darrow, could I have a moment?" Dancer and I leave my mother and Severo bickering about the smell of his wolf cloak to walk along a dirt footpath leading into the trees toward the lake. A patrol skiff skims the water on the far shore.
"How are you?" he asks me. "None of that patriotic hero shit. Remember, I know all your tells."
"Tired," I admit.
You'd think a month's journey back would let me catch up on sleep. But there's always something. Can you sleep? He asks. Sometimes. Lucky bastard. I pissed the bed, he admits. Probably twice a month. I don't ever remember the bloody damn dreams, but my body sure as hell does.
He was in the thick of the fighting to free Mars.
The tunnel wars there were even nastier than the block fighting on Luna. Even the Obsidians don't sing songs of their victories in the tunnels. The Rat War, they call it.
Over the course of 3 years, Dancer personally liberated over 100 mines with the Sons of Ares. Iphigenia is the father of the Rising. It'd be fair to call Dancer the favourite uncle, despite the dissolution of the Sons of Ares.
You can take the meds, I say. Most of the vets do. Psych meds! I don't need yellow synthetics. I'm a Red of Faran. My wits are damn sure more important than a dry bed.
On that, we agree. Even though he's my wife's main opposition in the Senate, and thereby mine, he's still as dear to me as my own family. Only when Mars and her moons were declared free did Dancer give up the gun and take up the senatorial toga to found the Vox Populi, the Voice of the People, a socialist low-colour party to counter what he saw as undue gold influence over the Republic. It's a bloody damn thorn in my boots every time he gives a speech on proportional representation. If he had his way, there'd be 500 low-colour senators to every gold senator. Good math, bad reality.
Still, must be good to feel grass under your boots instead of sand and metal, he said softly. Must be good to be home.
It is. I hesitate and look out at the rocky shore below. Gets harder every time to come back. You'd think I look forward to it, but I don't know. I dread it in a way. Every time Pax grows a centimetre, it feels like an indictment against me for not being there to see it. I pick a loose thread impatiently. Not to mention the longer I spend here, the more time the Ash Lord has to prepare Venus, and the longer this all stretches out.
His face hardens at the mention of the war.
And how long do you think this will stretch out?
That depends, doesn't it? I ask. You're the only thing standing in my way of getting the men I need to end this.
That's always your answer, isn't it?
More men.
He sighs.
I'm the mouth of the Vox Populi, not the brain.
You know, Dancer, humility isn't always a virtue.
You disobeyed the Senate, he says flatly. We did not give you permission to launch an iron rain. We preached caution, and
I won, didn't I?
This isn't the Sons of Ares any longer, much as you and I both wish it were. Virginia and her optimates were content to let you run roughshod over the Senate, but the people are learning just how strong their voice is.
He steps close to me.
Still, they revere you.
Not all of them.
Please. You've got cults that say prayers in your name. Who else has that?
Ragnar. I hesitate. And Lysander Auloon.
The line of Selenius died with Octavia.
You were a fool to let that boy go. But if he was alive, we'd know it.
He got swallowed up by the war just like the rest of them.
That leaves only you. The people love you, Darrow. You can't abuse that love. Whatever you do, you set an example.
So, if you don't follow the law, why should our imperators, our governors? Why should anyone else? How are we supposed to govern if you go off and do whatever you damn well please like you're at...
He catches himself.
A gold.
You know what I mean. The Senate was elected. You were not.
I do what's necessary. You and I always have. But the rest of them, they do what gets them re-elected. Why should I listen to them? I smile at him.
Maybe you want an apology.
Will that get me the men I need?
It may be too late for apologies.
I raise an eyebrow.
I wish I could say his coldness is alien to me, but that bond between us has never been the same since he learned how I bought my peace with Romulus.
I gave Romulus the sons of Ares.
Those were Dancer's men I left to die on the rim.
The guilt I felt for that defined our relationship for years, made me desperate for his approval. I thought, if I could destroy the Ash Lord, I could amend the horror I consigned those men and women to.
Nothing has been amended. Nothing will be. And it breaks my heart to know Dancer will never love me again the way I love him.
Are we threatening each other now, Dancer? Thought you and I were beyond that. We started this together.
Aye, we did. I care for you as if you were my own blood. Have ever since you came to me covered in dirt, no taller than my nose. But even you have to follow the laws of the Republic you helped build, because when the law is not obeyed, the ground is fertile for tyrants. I sigh. You've been reading again.
Damn right. The Gauls hoarded our history so they could pretend they owned it. It's my duty, as a free man, to read, so I'm not blind, being led around by my nose.
No one is leading you around by your nose. He snorts his disagreement. When I was a soldier, I watched as your wife gave pardons to murderers, to slavers, and I bore it because I was told it was necessary to win the war. I watch now as our people live 15 to a room with scraps for food, rags for healthcare, while the high-colour aristocracy live in towers. And I bear it because I'm told it is necessary to win the war. I'll be damned if I sit back and watch another tyrant replace the one we left behind because it is necessary to win the fucking war.
Spare me the speeches, man. My wife's no tyrant. It was her idea to diminish the strength of the sovereign in the new compact. Her choice to give that strength to the Senate. She helped give our people a voice. You think that was convenient for her? You think that's what a tyrant would do?
He fixes me with hard eyes. I wasn't talking about her.
I see. I remember when you told me I was a good man who'd have to do bad things, I say. Your stomach goes soft. Or have you spent so much time with politicians that you've forgotten what the enemy looks like? Usually they're about 7 foot tall, wear a big pyramid badge. Oh, and they've got red blood all over their hands.
And so do you, he says. 1 million was the total loss, wasn't it?
1 million for Mercury.
You might be willing to bear that, but the rest of us tire of the weight. I know the Obsidians do. I know I do.
So that leaves us at an impasse.
It does.
You're my friend, he says, voice heavy with emotion. You will always be my friend. I won't put a dagger in your back. But I will stand up to you. I will do what is right.
And so will I.
I put out my hand. He takes it and lingers for a moment before walking down the path. He turns before it bends into the trees.
Is there something you're not telling me, Darrow? If there is, now is the time. When it's between just us friends.
I've no secrets from you, I say,
wishing it were true, wishing he believed me.
wishing he were still the leader of the Sons of Ares, so we could bear our secrets together like we once did. Sadly, not all adversaries are enemies. He turns and limps back to the garden to say farewell to my mother. They embrace, and he makes his way to the southern landing pads, where his warden escorts wait. He takes a white wool toga from one and puts it on over his shirt before he goes up the ramp.
What did he want? Severo asks.
What do all politicians want?
Prostitutes.
Control.
He knows about the emissaries?
He couldn't. Severo watches Dancer's wool toga billow in the wind as he boards his shuttle.
I liked the bastard better in armor.
So did I.
Chapter 3. Darrow. The Fantasy. Dinner is served shortly after Daxo and Mustang arrive from Hyperion, with my brother Kieran and niece Rona. We eat at a long wooden table, covered with candles and hearty provincial Martian dishes spiced with curry and cardamom. Severo, swarmed by his daughters, makes faces at them as they eat. But when the air cracks with a sonic boom, he bolts upright, looks at the sky, and runs off into the house, urging his children to stay put. He returns a whole half an hour later, arm in arm with his wife, hair a mess, two jacket buttons missing, touching a white napkin to a bloodied split lip. My old friend Victra, immaculate in a high-collared green jacket threaded with gemstones, beams devilishly across the patio at me. She's 7 months pregnant with her fourth daughter.
Well, if it isn't the Reaper in the leathery flesh. Apologies, my good man, I'm dreadfully late.
Her long legs cover the distance in three strides. I greet her with a hug. She squeezes my butt hard enough to make me jump. She kisses Mustang on the head and slides into a chair dominating the table.
Hello, gloomy one, she says to Electra.
She looks at young Pax and Baldur, who have been huddled conspiratorially at the far end of the table. Both boys flush furiously.
Will one of you handsome lads pour Auntie Victra some juice? She's had a hellish day.
They scramble over one another to be the first to grab the pitcher. Baldur wins, and, pleased as a peacock, the quiet obsidian lad solemnly pours Victra a towering glass.
Damnable Mechanics Union is on strike again. I've got docks full of freight that's ready to move, but the little bastards got all spiced up by a Vox Populi mouthpiece and took the power couplings out of more than half the ships in my lunar food haulers and hid them.
What do they want? Mustang asks.
Aside from the moon to starve, higher wages, better living conditions, the usual tripe. They say it's too expensive to live on Luna with their wages. Well, there's plenty of room on Earth. How ungrateful of the unwashed peasants, my mother says. I detect your sarcasm, Diana, and I'm choosing to ignore it in honour of our recently returned heroes. There will be enough debate later in the week. Anyway, I'm practically a saint. Mother would have had sent Greys in to crack their ungrateful skulls. Thank Jove the tin men still bloody any vox, they say.
It's their right to bargain, collectively, Mustang says, reaching down to wipe a bit of hummus off the face of Severo's youngest, Diana. Written in ink in the new compact.
Yes, of course it is. Unions are the heart of fair labour.
Victra mutters. It's the only thing Quicksilver and I agree upon. Mustang smiles.
Better. You're a paragon of the Republic once again.
You only just missed Dancer, Severo says.
I thought it reeked of self-righteousness.
Victra goes to sip her juice and jumps in surprise. Baldur still stands at her side, smiling a bit too earnestly.
Oh! You're still here. Begone, creature.
She kisses her fingers and then presses them to Baldur's cheek, pushing him away. He goes, drifting on air back to my envious son. Afterwards, as the children go off into the vineyard to play, we retire to the back grotto. My family, those by blood and by choice, surround me. For the first time in over a year, I feel peace settling into me. My wife puts her feet in my lap and instructs me to rub them. I think Pax is in love with you, Victra. Mustang laughs as Daxo pours her a glass of wine. His hands dwarf the bottle. A taller man than I am, he has difficulty sitting in his chair and keeps accidentally kicking my shins under the table. Kieran and his wife, Dio, hold hands on a bench by the fire. When I was younger, I remember thinking how much she looked like Io. But now, as time passes, the shadow of my wife's face fades, and I see only the woman who is the center of my brother's being. She lurches forward suddenly, away from a shower of embers as Niobe dumps another log on the flames. Thraxa sits off in the corner, furtively lighting a burner.
Well, Pax could have worse an idol than his godmother, Victra says, eyeing her husband, who is picking his teeth with a splinter of wood he's prized from the outdoor table. She pushes him with her foot. That's grotesque. Stop.
Sorry.
Yet you're not stopping. Bit of gristle, my love.
He turns like he's throwing the splinter away, but keeps picking.
Got it, he says gloomily.
Instead of throwing the salvaged gristle to the side, he chews on it and swallows. Beef.
Beef?
Mustang looks back at the table.
We had chicken and lamb.
Several frowns.
Odd. Kieran, when did we last have beef?
At the Howler dinner, 3 days ago.
Noses wrinkle around the table. Severo chuckles to himself.
Then it was well-aged.
Daxo shakes his head and continues sketching angels for Diana, who sits on his lap, admiring the man's work. He's no fool with a razor, but his true art is made with a stylus. Victra looks helplessly at Mustang over her juice, despairing of her husband.
Proof, my dear, that love is blind.
Nicky can fix that face if you're tired of looking at it, I say.
Good luck. You'd have to pry the decadent sprite away from his laboratory, Daxo says.
The bald man considers Diana's addition of a cruelly barbed trident to the angel he's drawn.
Not to mention his admirers. He brought quite the menagerie to the opera last September. It was a bit like a Hieronymus Bosch painting come alive. One of them was even an actress. Can you imagine?
He asks Mustang.
Your father would have chewed through his cheek to see low colour sitting in the Elorian.
He's not the only one, Victor says. Too much new money these days. Quicksilver's friends.
She shivers.
Well, money doesn't buy culture, does it?
Daxo replies.
Not at all, my goodman. Not at all.
As the night deepens, the orange fingers of the slow sunset thread their way through the trees. I let go of the strain in my shoulders and sink deeper into my cup, listening to my friends chatter and joke, while little blue bugs flicker and stab violent light into the late summer twilight. The trees rustle beyond the terrace, the shouts of children coming from the grounds as they play night games. The blistering sand seas of Mercury seem so far away now. The stench of war so remote in my mind, they are little more than shards of half-forgotten dreams. This is how life should be. This peace. This laughter. But even now I feel it slipping through my fingers like that faraway sand. I sense the House Augustus Lion Guards out in the darkness of the forest, watching the sky, the shadows, helping us stay inside the fantasy a moment longer. Mustang catches my eye and nods toward the door. Forcing myself to part ways from my friends, as the Telemannises give a rousing, drunken rendition of their family's song, The Fox of Summerfall, I follow several minutes after Mustang disappears into the main house. The manor halls here are older even than those of the Citadel of Light. History is the mortar of the place. Relics from older ages adorn walls, festoon shelves. Octavia called this place home as a child. Her essence lingers in the rafters and the attic and the gardens, as do those of her ancestors and child. It is where Lysander would have played long before his path crossed mine. I feel the imprint the loons have left on the home. At first, I thought it strange living in the house of my greatest enemy, but in all humanity, who knew the burdens Mustang and I face as well as Octavia? In life, I loathed her. In death, I understand her. The scent of my wife reaches me before the sight of her. Our room is warm, and the door shudders shut behind me on a rusted metal latch. A bottle of wine is open on the table beside the fireplace, where eagles and crescent moons of house loon are carved into the stone corbels. Mustang's slippers lie discarded on the floor. The ring of her father and my House Mars ring rest on the table beside her datapad, which flashes away with new messages. She spooled herself into a chair on our veranda, like a bit of golden yarn, reading the dog-eared book of Shelley's poetry Roke gave her years ago during their summer of opera and art in Aegea, after the Institute. She doesn't look up as I approach. I stand behind her, considering better of speaking, and slide a hand through her hair. I knead my thumbs into the muscles of her neck and back. Her proud shoulders relent against my fingers, and she turns her book over in her lap. Sharing a life threads more than flesh and blood together. It weaves her memories in and around and through mine. The more I know of her, the more I share of her, the more I love her. In a way the boy I used to be never knew how to love. Io was a flame, dancing against the wind. I tried to catch her, tried to hold her, but she was never meant to be held. My wife is not as fickle as a flame. She is an ocean. I knew from the first that I cannot own her, cannot tame her, but I am the only storm that moves her depths and stirs her tides. And that is more than enough. I lower my lips to her neck and taste the alcohol and sandalwood of her perfume. I breathe slow and easy, feeling the lightness of love and the wordless unspooling of the sea of space that kept us apart. Impossible, it seems, that we were ever so distant, that there was ever a time where she existed and I was not with her. Everything that she is, every scent, taste, touch, makes me know I am home. She reaches up, dragging her slender fingers through my hair. I missed you, I say. What's not to miss? She asks, giving me a sly smile. I move to sit with her on the chaise, but she clucks her tongue. You're not done yet. Keep rubbing, Imperator. Your sovereign commands it. I think power's gone to your head. She glances up at me. Yes, ma'am. I continue massaging her neck. I'm drunk, she mutters. I can already feel the hangover. Thraxa's good at making it feel like a moral obligation to keep pace. 10 credits says we have to scrape Severo off the patio tomorrow.
Poor goblin. All spirit, no body mass. She laughs.
I put him and Victor in the West Wing so we can actually get some sleep. Last time I woke up in the middle of the night thinking a coyote was caught in the air recycler. I swear, at the pace they're going, they'll be able to single-handedly populate Pluto in a few years. She pats the cushion beside her. I join her on the chaise and wrap my arms around her. The lake breeze sighs through the trees. In the silence we share, I feel her heartbeat and wonder what her eyes see as they look out over the tops of the trees to the orange sky. Dancer was here, I say. She makes a small noise of acknowledgement to let me know she resents my reminder of the world beyond our balcony. He's not happy with you. Half the Senate looked like they wanted to poison my wine. I warned you. Luna's changed since you were gone. The Vox Populi can't be ignored any longer.
I noticed.
Yet when they passed a resolution, you spat in their eye. And now they'll spit in mine. Seems that's the bed you made.
Do they have the votes to block my request?
They might.
Even if you apply pressure.
You mean even if I clean up your mess?
It wasn't a question.
I made the right decision, I say. I know I did. You know I did. They don't know war. They were afraid of being held responsible for failure. What was I supposed to do? Comb my hair while they protected their reputations?
Maybe you should learn from them.
I'm not going to hold a poll in the middle of a war. You could have vetoed them.
I could have. But then they'd cry that I was protecting my husband, and the Vox would gain even more supporters.
Copper and obsidian are still in play.
No. Caraval says the coppers will back you. As goes Sephi, so goes obsidian. What will she choose? You'd know better than I.
I don't know, I admit. She was against the rain, but she came with me.
She's silent at that.
You think I've shot us in the foot, don't you?
Does Dancer have anything else he can use against you?
No, I say. I know she doesn't believe me. And she knows I know. But she can't ask any more. Though I want to tell her about the emissaries, it would incriminate her as well.
Severo and I agreed it was a secret that must stay within the Howlers. She would be bound by oath to tell the Senate. And she tried so hard to honor her new oaths.
Dancer's not the only one angry with me, I say. Pax would hardly look at me at dinner.
I saw.
I don't know what to do.
I think you do.
She goes quiet.
We're missing this, she says eventually. Life. The dinner tonight, I'll remember forever. The lightning bugs, the children in the yard, the smell of rain on its way.
She looks over at me.
Just seeing you laughing. I shouldn't remember it. It should be one of thousands.
What are you saying?
I'm saying that when my term of office ends in 2 years, maybe I won't run again. Maybe I let the torch pass to someone else. You hand the reins to Orion or Harnassus. Maybe the rest of this isn't our responsibility.
A tiny, hopeful smile crosses her lips.
We will go back to Mars and live in my estate. We'll raise our children with your brother and sisters and put our lives into helping our family, our planet. And each night we'd have a dinner like this one. Friends could come and go in our house whenever they passed through. The door would always be open.
And an army would always have to guard it. Her words carry away into the night, into the arms of the swaying trees, along with the current of the wind, up and up into the sky, where it seems all fantasies go. But I sit cold as a stone beside her, because I know she doesn't believe any of this. We've played the game far too long to walk away. I take her hand, and as my wife is quiet and the fantasy drifts away, our familiar friend, Dread, creeps onto the balcony with us. Because deep inside, in the shadowy chasms of ourselves, we know Lorne was right. For those who dine with war and empire, the bill always comes at the end. And almost as if the world was listening to my thoughts, a knock comes at the door. Mustang answers it, and when she returns, her face belongs to the sovereign, not my wife. It was Daxo. Dancers called an emergency session of the Senate. They've moved your hearing up to tomorrow night.
What does that mean?
Nothing good.